We are very grateful you are here with us. This is session 31, National Culture, Personality, and Theocracy in the Early Mormon Culture of Violence. Our presenter will be D. Michael Quinn. We feel very fortunate to have Michael Quinn with us. He is currently a Beinecke Senior Fellow at Yale University. He is the author of numerous books, including most recently a significantly revised and expanded version of his biography of J. Reuben Clark. He is the author of Same-Sex Dynamics Among 19th Century Americans, A Mormon Example, the Mormon Hierarchy Series, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview in two editions. The first edition won Best Book Award from the Mormon History Association. Many articles, including LDS Church Authority, I believe, and New Plural Marriages, which was just a phenomenal article. You have to read it a few times to get all the information in there. He has a lot to share with us, so why don't we get right to it and turn the time over to Michael Quinn.
Thank you. While speaking from my comfortable distance about the early Mormon culture of violence, I never forget those animals who proudly called themselves anti-Mormons. My first ancestral Mormon mother, Lydia Bellew Workman, died in Nauvoo, Illinois on 30 September 1845, a few days after she had been burned out of her home by mobs. She left her five youngest children aged 6 through 18. It is extremely difficult for most of us today to comprehend the violence that was pervasive, often normative, in early American culture. Much of this normative violence reflected the national society, while regions such as the South and the West had their own traditions of sanctioned violence in daily life. In other instances, the rowdyism and violence were normative only for a subculture that was defined primarily by social class or ethnicity. Early Americans had perspectives about violence that were very different even from those of us who have served in the military or lived in war-torn societies, because nearly all of us grew up in peaceful environments where violence was a disapproved violation of social norms. To begin, Robert Shoemaker has observed of England's traditions of male honor before 1800. Quote, "In sum, violence for men was part of accepted codes of masculine behavior and offered them a means of affirming their gender identity, and gentlemen a means of confirming their superior social position," unquote. Nevertheless, his statistical analysis showed that urban Englishmen of all classes were becoming less violent during the decades before 1800. Part of the reason for this decline of violence was the growing success of English common law's duty to retreat. Correspondingly, a crucial factor in the history of American violence was this nation's 19th century abandonment of this aspect of the common law. Richard Maxwell Brown observes that this had produced in Britain a centuries-old, quote, society of civility, for obedience to the duty to retreat, really a duty to flee from the scene altogether, or failing that, to retreat to the wall at one's back, meant that the vast majority of disputes had no fatal outcome, unquote. Beginning with an 1806 decision by a Massachusetts court, gradually, quote, "the nation as a whole repudiated English common law tradition in favor of the American no duty to retreat, that one was legally justified in standing one's ground to kill in self-defense," unquote. This resulted in America's what he called proud new tolerance for killing in situations where it might have been avoided by obeying a legal duty to retreat. During the same period, America's norms were changing concerning violence by boys and teenagers. E. Anthony Rotundo observes, quote, "In the early 1800s, men and women had seen youthful brawls as a badge of evil and a sign that manly self-control was not yet developed. However, during a decades-long tradition, bourgeois Northerners did more than endorse interpersonal violence. They now believed that fighting helped to build youthful character," unquote. A few examples may be helpful in recognizing this early American culture of violence, which extended from the elites to the underclasses, from the cities to the villages, from north to south, from the eastern establishment to the western frontier. Although dueling, usually with pistols, was permitted by the laws of various states and was regarded as honorable by most Americans of the time, Thomas Jefferson in 1798 persuaded Ambassador and future President James Monroe against trying to kill U.S. President John Adams in a duel. Alexander Hamilton, a founding father of the Republic and Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, died in an 1804 duel. Dueling in the nation's capital also included, quote, an affair of honor, unquote, between Secretary of State Henry Clay and Senator John Randolph. Known for dueling while he was a justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court in the early 1800s, Andrew Jackson killed one opponent in 1806, engaged in a hotel brawl as an army general with Senator Thomas Hart Benton in 1813, massacred countless Creek Indian women and children, including hundreds on a single day, executed six Tennessee militiamen in 1814 for leaving camp when they thought their enlistments had expired, illegally invaded Spanish territory of Florida in 1818, and hanged two British men for befriending the Seminole Indians there, and yet Jackson was elected U.S. President in 1828. As governor of Illinois Territory, William Henry Harrison declared, quote, a war of extirpation, unquote, against the Kickapoo Indians who opposed white settlement on their ancestral lands. And he successfully used this to get elected as U.S. President in 1840. In 1842, Abraham Lincoln nearly engaged in a sword duel with the Illinois State's auditor. Violence in the classroom was also common in early America. Now, this would never have happened at Yale. But at Princeton University, students burned down the library in 1802 and engaged in five other major campus rebellions before 1830. Student rioting and violence also plagued the University of Virginia during the 1830s and 1840s. The problem was even worse at public schools struggling to teach the children of farmers, shopkeepers, and common laborers. In 1837 alone, 400 schools had to close in Massachusetts because of violence and disciplinary problems. From colonial times to the mid-1840s, it was also a tradition on Sundays for young men to commit organized and spontaneous mayhem in Philadelphia. The pervasiveness of violence in early American culture, particularly by men, leads to an obvious question. Did every early American man, or even the vast majority, commit assault and battery? Existing evidence indicates the answer is no for a large portion of American males during that era. Why did many early American males avoid violence, even though it was socially sanctioned? Opinion polls did not exist. Relatively few American males wrote diaries or letters about their personal feelings, and even fewer commented about their responses to violence, aside from service in the military. Therefore, the answer can be only tentative. But many of early America's males apparently declined to participate in its culture of violence because of some combination of the following factors: non-aggressiveness in their personalities, their religious response to the Christian advice to turn the other cheek, their family indoctrination against violence, or their perception that there was never sufficient cause for them to resort to violence in their daily lives. Now, this existence of nonviolence within early American population leads to a separate question about the term with which I began this discussion. Would we be justified in denying that there was, quote-unquote, a culture of violence in early America, simply because many of its males and nearly all of its females avoided violence? The answer to that question involves more than arrest records or anecdotal references to violent incidents or even estimates of those who did not engage in violent acts. The first question really depends on the answer to a more fundamental question. What were the norms of the society regarding violence? Of the previously cited examples of legally and socially sanctioned violence in daily life, and of the election of national leaders with violent reputations, it should be obvious why historians regard early America as a violent culture. The incidents of violence are certainly important, both individually and statistically. However, the crucial question is whether the violent incidents occurred in concert with the society's norms or in opposition to its norms. This national context leads to the question of early Mormonism and what I identify as its culture of violence. Again, this is difficult to relate to for the vast majority of those who follow the restoration message that began with the 1830 Book of Mormon. Its narratives endorsed self-defensive wars, but also expressed discomfort or condemnation of violence in daily life. Members of the Community of Christ, headquartered in Independence, Missouri, can point to a tradition of gentle coexistence with their neighbors, which extends to the movement's founding in the 1850s. Members of the LDS Church, headquartered in Salt Lake City, can point to a similar tradition throughout their own lifetime and that of their parents, grandparents, and sometimes great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents. However, the Utah Church's peaceful norms extend only to the 1890s. And the Community of Christ norms do not define the Mormonism which existed before the reorganization of the 1850s. To avoid the presentist bias of trying to make the past conform to our own experience and worldviews, we need to explore the personalities, norms, and behaviors of early Mormonism concerning violence. In the above sentence, I mentioned personalities first because prior to the existence of Mormonism's norms, its founder, Joseph Smith Jr., had developed personality traits which interacted with the norms of the church he led from 1830 to his death in 1844. On one hand, in 1836, a Kirtland resident called him, quote, a pugnacious prophet, unquote, which described a recurring aspect of Smith's personality. He physically assaulted those who offended him, and he spoke with pride about these violent incidents. His followers might justify such personal behaviors with religious proof texts about Jesus using a whip on money changers in the temple at Jerusalem. But the Mormon prophets resorting to assault and battery also reflected early America's culture of violence and its code of male honor. On the other hand, as God's living prophet and mouthpiece on earth, he also claimed that Mormons had the religious right to take vengeance on their enemies and had the theocratic right to form private armies. Joseph Smith's personality and his theocratic teachings were the joint basis for early Mormonism's norms for violent behavior. This resulted in a violent religious subculture within a violent national culture. In Palmyra, New York, probably in the 1820s, Smith confronted a wife beater, quote, I whipped him till he said he had enough, unquote. He also told Mormon friends another, quote, anecdote. While young, his father had a fine large watchdog, which bit off an ear from David Stafford's hog, which Stafford had turned into Smith's cornfield. Stafford shot the dog and with six other fellows pitched upon him, Joseph, unawares. Joseph whipped the whole of them and escaped unhurt, which they swore to as recorded in Hurl Burt's or Howe's book, unquote. Not surprisingly, the official history of the church published in Salt Lake City deleted this passage from the prophet's personal journal, which endorsed the accuracy of affidavits by his Palmyra neighbors as published in the first anti-Mormon book, Mormonism Unveiled. However, despite these violent incidents, and these are one due to his code of male honor and one in self-defense, the first few years of Smith's leadership of the church were remarkably nonviolent. His pacifism was most extraordinary in March 1832. A mob broke into the homes of the church president and his counselor, Sidney Rigdon, in Hiram, Ohio, dragged them from their beds, attempted to poison Smith, nearly castrated him, beat both men unconscious, and then tarred and feathered them. Worse, the prophet's adopted child died from exposure to the cold as the mob ransacked his house. Nevertheless, Smith preached the next day to a congregation which included several of his attackers, and he sought no retribution. Among this mob was a former friend, apostate Simmons Ryder. I find it difficult to explain in satisfactorily human terms how Joseph Smith could manifest such Quaker-like pacifism in his personal response to this physical attack on himself and his family in 1832, and yet could lash out with vehemence at far lesser provocations during the last 10 years of his life. To explain his behavior in 1832, I think that the Mormon prophet felt or believed, that Mormonism required him to live a higher standard. However, that changed. Perhaps hackneyed phrases like straw that broke the camel's back or dam bursting applied to the cumulative effect of the years of religious ridicule and personal insults, both of which provoked his conventionally American code of honor. At any rate, it is easier to explain the theocratic basis for various aspects of his religious leadership in violence after 1832. Because Smith's 1832 example was the only guide his followers had for how they should respond to violent attacks, Mormons behaved as pacifists when Missourians attacked them in Jackson County during July 1833. Mobs destroyed the Mormon newspaper, the home of editor William W. Phelps, and burned nearly all copies of the newly printed Book of Commandments, the first collection of Smith's revelations. Then the mob tarred and feathered Bishop Edward Partridge and other Mormon men for not agreeing to leave the county immediately. The Missouri Mormons gave no resistance to these attacks, brandished no weapons, and did not speak of revenge. As resident John Coral wrote, quote, up to this time the Mormons had not so much as lifted a finger, even in their own defense, so tenacious were they for the precepts of the gospel, turn the other cheek, unquote. That changed after Smith made the first revelatory pronouncement that Mormon theocracy was a here-and-now reality, not some distant event connected with the millennial return of Jesus. In August 1833, he announced the words of God, quote, and now verily I say unto you concerning the laws of the land, it is my will that my people should observe to do all things whatsoever I command them. The document also required Mormons to obey divine rule, not secular authority concerning war and militarism, unquote. And again, this is a law that I gave unto my ancients, that they should not go out into battle against any nation, kindred, tongue, or people, save I the Lord them, unquote. The revelation implied that God would reveal such commands through the LDS prophet. That became explicit within months when Joseph Smith became the theocratic commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel. Having previously endured an anti-Mormon attack without retribution, the Mormon community in Missouri responded to this document's instructions to endure a total of three attacks and, quote, bear it patiently, unquote. However, on the fourth attack by anti-Mormons, the revelation specified, quote, thine enemy is in thine hands, and thou art justified, unquote. This theocratic justification extended to vengeance against, quote, all their enemies, to the third and fourth generation, unquote. In October 1833, Missourians raided isolated Mormon homes, which was the second major attack of your enemy. On 1 November, mobs destroyed the church's gristmill in Independence and attacked Mormon homes there. This was the third attack, and in compliance with the August revelation, they again chose to, quote, bear it patiently, unquote. The next night, the Missourians raided Mormon settlements in the Blue River Valley. This time, the fourth attack. The Mormons surprised, I think shocked, their enemy by fighting back. Skirmishes increased until the Battle of Blue River on 4 November, when Book of Mormon witness David Whitmer led the Mormons in killing two Missourians and severely wounding others. In response, Jackson County civil leaders called out the militia, to whom the Mormons surrendered their weapons and began leaving their homes. It is possible that the 1833 Missouri mobbings caused the prophet to enlist some of his followers as bodyguards, but the practice would have been understandable after his being tarred and feathered in 1832. In any event, a non-Mormon in Ohio wrote in January 1834 that, quote, Smith has four or five armed men to guard him every night, unquote. A month later, Smith dictated a revelation concerning, quote, the redemption of your brethren who have been scattered on the land of Zion, and in avenging me of his, unquote. In order to do this, the revelation commanded Smith to organize, quote, at least 100 of the strength of my house, to go up with you unto the land, adding the instruction, and whoso is not willing to lay down his life for my sake is not my disciple, unquote. This was the beginning of a Mormon military expedition called Zion's Camp. Perhaps the most significant dimension of this commandment was in verse 1. It's provision that, quote, ye shall avenge me of mine enemies unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. That was a specific reference to the 1833 revelation and verified that the restraints of that earlier revelation had now been fulfilled. and that the Latter-day Saints were now free to take, quote, vengeance at will against any perceived enemy. This February 1834 revelation was the equivalent of a standing order from God: you may fire when ready. Zion's camp did not succeed in redeeming Zion, but it transformed Mormon leadership and culture. In February 1834, the High Council in Kirtland, Ohio, also elected Joseph Smith as Commander-in-Chief of the Armies of Israel, unquote. This was one of the first acts of the newly organized High Council, which thus acknowledged Smith's religious right to give God's commands, as specified in the 1833 revelation, quote, to go out and to battle against any nation, kindred, tongue, or people, unquote. Zion's camp was the first organization established for the external security of Mormonism. In June 1834, Joseph Smith created the second by reorganizing his private bodyguards into an organization led by a captain, his brother Hiram, who presided over 20 of, quote, my lifeguards, unquote. 6 months later, the military experience of Zion's camp, rather than any ecclesiastical service, was the basis upon which Joseph Smith said, specifically, that he was selecting men for the newly organized Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the 70. Unlike other American religious denominations, the phrase "the church militant" indicated a literal fact in Mormonism. It was not just symbolic slogans. During this period, Joseph Smith was also involved in several outbursts of personal violence in Kirtland. After a Baptist minister threatened him with a cane, the prophet said, quote, I whipped him till he begged. He threatened to prosecute me. I sent Luke Johnson, the constable, after him, and he run him out of the county into Mentor, unquote. Johnson, who was the constable, explained that this occurred because the minister, after receiving the hospitality of the prophet's home, then, quote, called Joseph a hypocrite, a liar, an impostor, and a false prophet, and called upon him to repent. Therefore, Joseph boxed his ears with both hands, and turning his face toward the door, kicked him into the street, unquote. In April 1835, Smith's brother-in-law, Calvin W. Stoddard, accused him of assault and battery. At a preliminary hearing, the judge ruled that, quote, it is considered that the charge is sustained, and the prophet was bound over for trial at the Court of Common Pleas. However, because Stoddard failed to appear at the May trial, Smith was acquitted, and the plaintiff had to pay court costs. Despite this charge of battering his brother-in-law in a dispute during the spring, the prophet showed remarkable restraint in the fall with his brother William. His own brother had an equally pugnacious reputation, as did Joseph. Because Joseph would not allow their mother to testify at a high council trial, William Smith, quote, became enraged. I finally ordered him to sit down. He said he would not unless I knocked him down, unquote. Although furious with his brother, Joseph did not respond to this challenge with violence. Concerning a subsequent argument, Joseph even wrote that William, quote, used violence upon my person, unquote. However, this fraternal conflict of 85 had a final outcome which the prophet's diary and official history did not mention. His devoted friend, Benjamin F. Johnson, a Kirtland resident, noted that, quote, for insolence to him, he soundly thrashed his brother William, who boasted himself as invincible, unquote. Less than 4 years later, Smith's former secretary, Warren Parrish, referred in print to these incidents. He condemned, quote, the prophet's fighting four pitched battles at fisticuff without 4 years, one with his own natural brother, one with his brother-in-law, one with Ezra Thayer, and one with a Baptist priest, unquote. His statement was endorsed by two disaffected apostles and two disaffected presidents of the 70. However, rather than being disaffected by such personal violence, some faithful Mormons cited these incidents as justification for their own aggressive behavior. Elijah Abel served a proselytizing mission. After this African-American elder threatened to, quote, knock down Elder Christopher Merkley on their passage up Lake Ontario, he publicly declared that the elders in Kirtland make nothing of knocking down one another, unquote. Elijah had been ordained to the offices of elder in 70 in Kirtland. Jedediah M. Grant and Zenas H. Gurley disapproved of Abel's preaching this, and they formally accused him of misconduct. On 24 September 1835, in the absence of an external threat, Joseph Smith organized militarily in Kirtland. He proposed, quote, by the voice of the Spirit of the Lord, to raise another Mormon army to live and die on our own lands, which we have purchased in Jackson County, Missouri, unquote. His manuscript diary concluded in his own handwriting, quote, I ask God in the name of Jesus that in 800 men or 1,000 well-armed men that they may accomplish this great work, unquote. A 1,000-man army was a remarkable goal for an organization with less than 9,000 men, women, and children, which may be why the official LDS history changed the phrase to, quote, 1,000 emigrants, unquote. John Whitmer, who was church historian at this time, added something that Smith's diary left unstated. On this day, the High Council, by revelation, quote, unquote, appointed the church president as head of the War Department of the Lord's Hosts, unquote. This was a significant expansion of Smith's previous role as commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel, because War Department assumed crucial circumstances. First, he used the phrase which defined the jurisdiction of the U.S. Secretary of War, and this assumed a nationalist dimension in Mormonism. Second, because the U.S. War Department was a permanent function in war or peace at the time it was named Defense Department after World War II, Smith's military oversight was also permanent. Third, as head of Mormonism's War Department, he did not need to be a line officer in the field during hostilities. Like the U.S. Secretary of War, Smith now had oversight of all Mormon military operations. Fourth, he had no mortal superior, and therefore combined in himself the roles that the U.S. government found it wise to separate in time of war, military command and civilian oversight. In May 1836, a hostile resident referred to Kirtland's Mormons as, quote, a military array of ragamuffins headed by the modern Muhammad, unquote. Furthermore, tensions with non-Mormons at Kirtland led Joseph Smith to take an extraordinary step in November 1836. He and 11 other general authorities, including all four of his counselors in the First Presidency at that time, joined with 59 other Mormons in signing a warning to the non-LDS Justice of the Peace to, quote, depart forthwith from Kirtland, unquote. Of those who signed this warning against Kirtland's judicial officer, at least half a dozen later joined the Danites of Missouri. And this 1836 document foreshadowed their activities less than 2 years later. John Whitmer, the church historian at the time, probably meant this November ultimatum when he referred to the beginning of, quote, secret combinations in Kirtland in the fall of 1836, unquote. In another incident about which Smith's personal diary and official history are completely silent, he was acquitted in June 1837 of conspiring to murder anti-Mormon Grandison Newell. The silence may be due to the fact that two of Smith's supporting witnesses in the case, both apostles, acknowledged that the prophet discussed with them the possibility of killing Newell. Apostle Orson Hyde testified that, quote, Smith seemed much excited and declared that Newell should be put out of the way or where the crows could not find him. He said that destroying Newell would be justifiable in the sight of God and it was the will of God, etc., unquote. Hyde tried to be helpful by adding that he had, quote, never heard Smith use similar language before. And the apostle insisted, I have known him for some time and think him to be possessed of much kindness and humanity toward his fellow beings, unquote. Likewise, Apostle Lucas Johnson acknowledged to the court that Smith had said, quote, if Newell or any other man should head a mob against him, they ought to be put out of the way, and it would be our duty to do so, unquote. However, Johnson also affirmed, I believe Smith to be a tender-hearted, humane man, unquote. Whether or not the court agreed with that assessment, the judge acquitted Smith because there was insufficient evidence to support the charge of conspiracy to commit murder, and it was a non-Mormon judge. In the fall of 1837, David W. Patton investigated the prophet's secret relationship with his servant girl, Fanny Alger, and the hapless apostle collided with Smith's code of male honor. Brigham Young described what happened. Quote, David insulted Joseph, and Joseph slapped him in the face and kicked him out of the yard, unquote. However, the Mormon prophet's code of honor took offense at far lesser provocations. Benjamin F. Johnson reminisced that, quote, criticism, even by his associates, was rarely acceptable, and contradiction would rouse in him the lion at once. For by no one of his fellows would he be superseded or disputed, And in the early days at Kirtland and elsewhere, one or more of his associates were more than once, for their impudence, helped from the congregation by his, Joseph's, foot, unquote. When armed dissenters joined anti-Mormons in forcing Smith and his loyal followers to flee Kirtland in January 1838, this finalized a worldview that was indelible throughout the rest of the 19th century. Mormonism was fighting for its life against conspiracies of anti-Mormons and Mormon traitors. This is the context in which, as Marvin S. Hill observed, quote, the desire for refuge from pluralism and the uncertainty of choice in a free society encouraged a quest to eliminate opposition, both within and without the LDS Church, through intimidation and, when necessary, violence. As a result, whether the perceived threat has been actual or potential, the Mormon hierarchy has very rarely been far from a siege mentality. Some of Kirtland's dissenters also resettled at the new Mormon headquarters of Far West Missouri, where they then associated with local dissenters. Smith and his loyal followers were determined to prevent these formerly faithful leaders from causing mass defection once again. They did this through an organization which functioned both militarily and theocratically. In June 1838, Samson Avard, who considered himself an ultra-loyal Mormon, proposed organizing the Danites among other ultra-loyal Mormons. The Danites were the first civil appendage of Mormon power since 1834. Some historians have claimed that Joseph Smith and the rest of the First Presidency were unaware of the Danite organization, but documentary evidence shows otherwise. While the organization was still functioning, loyal LDS member and future general authority Albert P. Rockwell wrote in 1838, quote, the companies are called Danites because the prophet Daniel has said, the saints shall take the kingdom and possess it forever, unquote. 2 weeks after the formation of a second group at Adam-on-Diamond in Missouri, John Smith, who was its stake president, plus being a special counselor in the First Presidency, called the organization, quote, the Danites, unquote, in his diary, which also described Danite meetings as routine events. Soon the group developed an infamous reputation for intimidation of Mormon dissenters and its warfare against anti-Mormon militia. These two purposes were the explanation in Joseph Smith's own diary for why, quote, we have a company of Danites in these times, unquote. That didn't make it into the official history of the church, the 7-volume one. Counselor Rigdon later made a similar statement in the official church newspaper. Again, I didn't make it into the official history. Thus, the prophet's own diary corroborates the later statement by Ebenezer Robinson, who remained a believing Mormon, but regretted his Danite activities. Quote, both Joseph Smith Jr. and Signor Rigdon sanctioned and favored the only organization of Danites of which this reader has any knowledge, unquote. While describing Danite security arrangements, the manuscript autobiography of loyal Mormon Loonman A. Shirtliff revealed that Joseph Smith was also a Danite. In between two discussions of Danite, quote, signs and passwords, unquote, and Danite countersign, unquote, Shirtliff noted how the church president gave the necessary countersign as he approached Shirtliff, who was the night sentry. A little further in his narrative, Shirtliff added that while he was on guard duty with newly appointed apostle John Taylor, quote, I did not feel at liberty to use any sign or password because Brother Taylor was not a Danite, unquote. However, the LDS prophet was, and he used the Danite countersign. On 17 June 1838, First Counselor Sidney Rigdon preached his salt sermon as a warning that Mormon dissenters would be cast out and trodden under the foot of men, unquote. Rather than simply being an echo of Matthew 5:13, Rigdon's sermon was restating what an 1834 revelation had authorized the First Presidency to do to Mormons who, quote, hearken not to observe all my words, unquote. The next day, Second Counselor Hiram Smith and his uncle John Smith, an assistant counselor in the First Presidency, joined with Danite leader Samson Avard, who was the first signer, and 80 other Danites in a threatening letter to Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, John Whitmer, Lyman E. Johnson, and W.W. Phelps, who were now all dissenters. Presidency Counselor John Smith was the only general authority who signed both this 1838 warning and the earlier warning to Kirtland's Justice of the Peace. This Danite threat instructed these excommunicated dissenters to, quote, depart or more fatal calamity shall befall you, unquote. Ebenezer Robinson, one of the signers, later wrote that all the signers were members of the recently organized Danite military organization, and that he was told in June 1838 that this document, quote, was gotten up in the office of the First Presidency, unquote. Avard specified that Councillor Rigdon wrote the text of this Danite ultimatum. Although the Danites had been organized primarily for external security against the possibility of Missouri mobs, they now functioned as an organization for internal security to intimidate and possibly kill dissenting Mormons. Speaking of prominence who received this death threat in June, Joseph Smith's scriptory book, which again didn't make it into the official history of the church, said, quote, these men took warning, and soon they were seen bounding over the prairie like the scapegoat to carry off their own sins, unquote. Unable to see the situation in such lighthearted terms, dissenter John Whitmer wrote, quote, while we were gone, Joe and Rigdon and their band of Gadiantans kept up a guard and watched our house and abused our families and threatened them if they were not gone by morning, that they would be drove out and threatened our lives if they, the Danites, ever saw us in Far West, unquote. Gadianton was a Book of Mormon term for thieves and murderers who were bound by secret oaths. This 1838 ultimatum was not an aberration in Mormonism, but was a direct fulfillment of God's commandment 4 years earlier concerning unfaithful Latter-day Saints, quote, who call themselves after my name, unquote. Likewise, Stephen C. Lesueur observed, quote, the Danite organization was the product of, not an aberration from, Mormon attitudes and teachings. The Danites represented mainstream Mormonism in Missouri at this time, which was the subject of Lesueur's book, unquote. Despite trying to put the best face possible on this event, Utah historian Leland H. Gentry acknowledged, quote, the method chosen by the Latter-day Saints to rid themselves of their dissenting brethren was unfortunate, since it furnished the dissenters with further proof that the Saints were inimical to law and order. Regarding the Danite expulsion of prominent Mormon dissenters, Councillor Rigdon told Apostle Orson Hyde at Far West that, quote, it was the imperative duty of the church to obey the word of Joseph Smith or the First Presidency without question or inquiry, and that if there were any that would not, they should have their throats cut from ear to ear, unquote. Remarkably, an official LDS newspaper later published this verification of the First Presidency's 1838 authorization of theocratic killings. Benjamin Slade, a lifelong Mormon, soon testified that Councillor Rigdon referred to carrying out that threat shortly thereafter. Quote, yesterday a man had slipped his wind and was thrown into the bush, Rigdon told a closed-door meeting of Mormon men, apparently Danites. Then he added, quote, the man that lisps it shall die, unquote. Then on July 4th, a month before the county election, the First Presidency virtually dared the Missourians to try to stop Mormons from exercising their civil liberties. Quote, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination, Councillor Rigdon warned, for we will follow them till the last drop of their blood is spilled, or else they will have to exterminate us, unquote. Boggs was not the first one to use that word. Joseph Smith published this independence talk as a pamphlet, advertised it in the church periodical, and explained that Rigdon's sermon expressed, quote, the fixed determination of the saints in relation to the persecutors, for to be mobbed any more without taking vengeance we will not, unquote. Non-Mormons were prepared and determined to prevent Mormons from voting in Davis County, which was adjacent to the Mormon county, which had been established by the state. And this resulted in violence in the county seat of Gallatin in August 1838. Quote, the first thing that came into my mind was the covenants entered into by the Danites, wrote lifelong Mormon John L. Butler of this incident. He rallied the dozen other Mormons at the voting place by shouting, oh yes, you Danites, here is a job for us, unquote. Among the Danites he rallied to fight the Missourians was Samuel H. Smith, Book of Mormon witness and Briest prophet. This account was included in the LDS Church's official journal history, but didn't make it into the published seven-volume history. Although there were no fatalities, this Election Day battle between self-professed Danites and anti-Mormons started the virtual civil war that engulfed four Missouri counties. In retaliation for raids against isolated Mormon farms, Mormon forces, primarily if not exclusively Danites, pillaged two non-Mormon towns. There is no question, wrote BYU professor William G. Hartley, that Latter-day Saint Rangers burned buildings in Millport and Gallatin. I'm quoting, and this included the U.S. Post Office and County Treasurer's Office. In the most candid account ever written by a Utah Mormon historian about the Missouri Danites, he also acknowledged, quote, "It is certain that some of the Danites in Missouri played the thief, and it is possible, although unproven, that some one or two were murderers." Unquote. Nevertheless, Mormon marauding against non-Mormon Missourians by 1838 was mild by comparison with the brutality of the anti-Mormon militias. 3 days after Governor Lilburn W. Boggs issued a military order that the Mormons, quote, must be exterminated or driven from the state, unquote, a Missouri militia unit attacked the LDS settlement at Hahn's Mill on 30 October 1838. They shot at and wounded 13 fleeing women and children, then methodically killed 18 males, including the point-blank execution of aged 9 and 10. Militiamen also used a corn cutter to mutilate the still-living Thomas McBride. When the survivors found the elderly man, his corpse was, quote, literally mangled from head to foot. The day after that massacre, Joseph Smith and other LDS leaders surrendered to the Missouri militia, which had encircled Far West. After Samson Avar testified against him in open court, the prophet publicly repudiated the Danite general and his oath-bound organization. Charged with the capital crime of treason, the prophet and several colleagues remained in jail for 6 months before they escaped to Illinois. However, it is anachronistic to apply Smith's later rejection of Avard to the activities of the general and the Danite lawyer. Avard was the stalking horse for the first presidency from the summer to fall of 1838. The Danite Constitution specified, quote, "All officers shall be subject to the commands of the Captain General, Avard, given through the Secretary of War," unquote. The prophet had held the latter position by revelation in the church's War Department for 3 years. He had been commander-in-chief of the Army of Israel for 4 years. What the Danites did militarily during 1838 was by the general oversight and command of Joseph Smith, and their violent acts resulted in multiple disasters: the massacre of a Mormon settlement, the ransacking of LDS headquarters, the near execution of the church's leaders, and the expulsion of the entire Mormon population from Missouri. And that perspective is necessary to understand a curious dimension in the next stage of early Mormonism's culture of violence. During the balance of Smith's leadership, strident Mormon militarism coexisted with military nonviolence among the Mormons. Through negotiations with Illinois' political leaders eager for support of the block-voting Mormons, LDS headquarters in February 1841 gained a state-chartered private army, the Nauvoo Legion. The LDS president was its governor-appointed, not self-assumed, commander with the rank appointed by the governor of lieutenant general, which only Washington had held prior to that, George Washington. Aside from Smith, only George Washington held that rank. This 1842 Mormon army of 2,000 was the largest military organization in Illinois in 1842. Within 2 years, the Nauvoo Legion had about 5,000 men under arms, compared with the U.S. Army's total of less than 8,500 soldiers. Under Smith's direction, the Nauvoo Legion drilled and held mock battles. Nevertheless, it engaged in no violent actions, even when its commander was kidnapped, arrested, and nearly dragged back to Missouri for certain death. Haunted by the 1838 consequences of violent Mormon militarism, for which he had been clearly responsible, Smith limited himself to saber-rattling in Illinois. Although he avoided violent militarism, the LDS prophet expanded the Mormon culture of violence in personal, civil, and theocratic ways at Nauvoo, Illinois. He boasted of his past physical assaults, advocated theocratic blood atonement, and committed acts of assault and battery, all due to what he regarded as justifiable provocation. As an extension of Smith's spilling his blood on the ground doctrine, quote-unquote, which he did not publicly announce until 1843, it will probably never be known if the prophet privately authorized his bodyguard and former Danite, Orrin Porter Rockwell, to kill Missourianer Boggs in May 1842. Smith held Boggs directly responsible for the expulsion of Mormons from Jackson County in 1833 and for the disasters of 1838. Killing Boggs would have fit within the provisions of the 1833 revelation, as well as be consistent with another Danite's pledge to Joseph in 1839, quote, I from this day declare myself the avenger of the blood of those innocent men and the innocent cause of Zion, unquote. The prophet had this copied into his personal letter book. The attempt to kill Boggs also occurred 1 month after Smith received a revelation that has never been officially published. The full content of this document of 7 April 1842 is presently unknown, but it provided the ponderous name for a future theocratic organization that was nicknamed the Council of 50. Quote, "Verily thus saith the Lord, that the name, this is the name by which ye shall be called, the kingdom of God and his laws, with keys and powers thereof, and judgment in the hands of his servants, Amen, Christ." Unquote. Killing Boggs a month later would have been the first theocratic judgment in the hands of his servants. One of the new church newspapers, edited by the prophet's brother William, an apostle, called the attempted assassination, quote, "a noble deed," unquote. In May 1842, Joseph Smith also reorganized his bodyguards, who were primarily those with experience as Danites in Missouri. Former Danites such as Dimmock B. Huntington, Daniel Karn, and Albert P. Rockwell began serving as Nauvoo's, quote, "night watch," unquote. Previously a Danite captain, Rockwood had already been serving as, quote. In December 1842, a bounty hunter wrote to Missouri's governor, quote, "All our efforts to seize the renegade Smith have proved fruitless. He keeps constantly about him as a bodyguard some 12 to 14 enthusiastic fanatics, which makes a secret approach impossible," unquote. In January 1843, Smith told dinner guests about whipping the Protestant minister in Kirtland, quote, "till he begged," unquote. A month later, he preached publicly about whipping the Palmyra wife beater. On 28 March, the prophet wrote that 70s president, quote, "Josiah Butterfield, came to my house and insulted me so outrageously that I kicked him out of the house, across the yard, and into the street," unquote. This was another incident of upholding his male sense of honor. Also in March 1843, Joseph Smith told the Nauvoo City Council that he was opposed to hanging, quote, "If a man kill another, shoot him, or cut his throat, spilling his blood on the ground, and let the smoke thereof ascend up to God. If I ever have the privilege of making a law on this point, I will have it so," unquote. This echoed First Counselor Rigdon's throat-cutting statements to Mormons in Missouri 5 years earlier. Although his instructions about capital punishment to the city council could be viewed as a mayor's comment about secular laws, theocracy was the context of his comments as church president to the LDS conference on 6 April 1843. Quote, "I'll wring a thief's neck off if I can find him, if I cannot bring him to justice any other way," unquote. When former Danite John L. Butler heard his prophet speak on this occasion, he understood him to say, quote, that the time would come that the sinners would have their heads cut off so to save them. Butler said that the Spirit of God filled him as he listened to these words. This account was also included in the LDS Church's journal history. In June, Smith instructed the Nauvoo Mormons about the next stage of violence against their enemies. He warned what would happen, quote, "if Missouri continues her warfare and to issue her writs against me and this people unlawfully and unjustly. If they don't let me alone, I will turn up the world. I will make war," unquote. In August, the Mormon showed that he did not hesitate to physically assault a civil officer. Quote, "Walter Bagby called me a liar and picked up a stone to throw at me, which so enraged me that I followed him a few steps and struck him two or three times," unquote. He added in a sermon, "I seized him by the throat to choke him off," unquote. He pleaded guilty to assault and battery on the county tax collector, and the Nauvoo judge assessed a fine for this crime. Smith's secretary, William Clayton, added that Daniel H. Wells had ended the brawl when he, quote, "stepped between them and succeeded in separating them," unquote. But Smith obviously wanted to do more damage to Bagby, and complained in a sermon about, quote, "Esquire Wells interfering when he had no business," unquote. Concerning Nauvoo's Sunday meeting of September 17th, Joseph Smith's official history describes something I'm going to skip. Although not dated in this autobiography, which recorded it, the following incident may also have occurred in 1843. Ira N. Spaulding was riding in Smith's carriage when, quote, "there came a man who had a promissory note against Joseph. He talked kindly to the man and begged him to wait a short time for the money, as he could not pay him then. But good words would not satisfy him. He abused him, the prophet, shamefully, calling him every mean name he could think of," unquote. the man should have known this was not a wise thing for anyone to do. Smith, quote, stepped outside the carriage and knocked him down flat as a beef, not speaking a word, and came into the carriage and traveled on, unquote. Even the prophet's well-known hobby of wrestling manifested an unpleasant willingness to take physical advantage of smaller men. While celebrating Smith's athletic nature, Alexander L. Baugh of BYU noted, quote, on occasion, the prophet even challenged much smaller individuals we might consider to be the more non-athletic type to wrestle with him, unquote. He quoted Howard Curry about one example that ended badly. Smith told his devout follower, Brother Curry, I wish you were a little larger. I would like to have some fun with you. I replied, well, perhaps you can as it is, not realizing what I was saying. Joseph, a man of over 200 pounds weight, while I was scarcely 130 pounds, made it not a little ridiculous for me to think of engaging with him in anything like a scuffle. However, as soon as I made this reply, he began to trip me. He took in some kind of lock on my right leg from which I was unable to extricate it, and throwing me around, broke it some 3 inches above the ankle joint, unquote. Breaking Curry's leg was an accident which the prophet immediately regretted. However, Baugh did not comment on an obvious question. Why would a tall, husky man like Joseph Smith want to humiliate small, scrawny men by either easily defeating them in a wrestling match or giving them a challenge which they would lose honor by declining? It does not matter that he often wrestled larger men for sport or that he sometimes engaged in serious fights with several opponents at once. Whenever he challenged smaller, obviously weaker men, males, to a physical contest, he went beyond the male code of honor and engaged in the kind of behavior that Americans described at the time as, quote, bullying. This also puts another perspective on his boasting about beating up enemies till they begged him to stop. Despite his endorsements of decapitation in 1843, there is no evidence that Smith ever authorized such punishment in Nauvoo. However, one of his house girls, apparently in that November of 1843, wrote that Dr. Robert D. Foster, Surgeon General and Brigadier General of the Nauvoo Legion, had used a sword to decapitate a man execution style, quote, on the prairie 6 miles from LDS headquarters, unquote. Foster was not a dissenter then, but would become one within 4 months. In December 1843, Smith organized the police force of Nauvoo, which included mainly Danites. These men were proud of their Danite background. According to one complaining Mormon at Nauvoo, policeman Daniel Karn, quote, told me several times that Danitism was not down, said it was a good system, unquote. Karn laconically replied in Joseph Smith's presence, quote, Danitism is to stand by each other. That's all I know about Danitism, unquote. As mayor, Joseph Smith authorized his police to kill if his own life was endangered in December 1843 by, quote, a little doughhead and a right-hand Brutus, unquote. The latter remarks put the police on notice to look for Mormon dissenters as traitors. Within a week, Nauvoo's police terrified Smith's second counselor, William Law, and Nauvoo's stake president, William Marks, into fearing he had marked them for death. Both were foes of the prophet's secret practice of polygamy. On 11 March 1844, Joseph Smith secretly organized a council of 50 as a fulfillment of the revelation nearly 2 years earlier. Several months later, disaffected Mormons members of that council claimed that, quote, he swore them all to present secrecy under penalty of death, unquote. Although the 1844 minutes of the Council of 50 are sequestered in the LDS First Presidency's vault, the claim of a theocratic penalty of death in 1844 is verified by available minutes of later date, which referred to there being a penalty at the organization or establishment of the Council of 50. BYU Professor Hartley has written that the Missouri Danite oaths were, quote, not to betray each other, of the breaking of which could bring the, unquote. At least 18 members of the Council of 50 had already taken oaths as Danites before Smith required this new guarantee of deadly secrecy in the spring of 1844. To allow time for questions, I'm going to skip some other stuff about his appealing for the right to the national government for the right to establish a national army to move into the West. During contrary to the previous 5 years, he was no longer being content with mere saber rattling on the part of the armed forces he was leading. Uriah Brown was initiated into the secretive Council of 50 because of the prophet's 1844 interest in this non-Mormon's invention of, quote, liquid fire to destroy an army or navy, unquote. 30 years earlier, Brown had unsuccessfully offered his idea, quote, for destroying by fire the vessels of the enemy, unquote, in a proposal to the U.S. Navy. The last public endorsement of violence during Smith's life occurred in the General Conference on 6 April 1844. Sidney Rigdon undoubtedly startled many Mormons by announcing, quote, there are men standing in your midst that you can't do anything with them but cut their throat and bury them, unquote. The prophet said nothing in dissent from his first counselor's remarks. 10 weeks later, Joseph Smith died as a martyr to his faith in Carthage Jail. But he was neither a willing nor a nonviolent martyr. As the mob clambered up the stairs, he fired at them with a six-shooter pistol, wounding three. Mormon culture became increasingly violent following the murder of its founding prophet. Claiming apostolic succession from his fallen leader, Brigham Young authorized assault and battery against Nauvoo dissidents and applauded Porter Rockwell for killing some of those identified as involved in murdering Smith and other Mormons. On the Pioneer Trail and in the Utah Society, Young increasingly preached about blood atonement against sinful Mormons and about, quote, avenging the blood of the prophets, unquote, against anti-Mormons. These themes of violence and vengeance became both normative and pervasive in LDS sermons, hymns, newspaper editorials, and patriarchal blessings for decades. However, LDS apologists claimed that the faithful Mormons were really nonviolent pioneers, regarded as mere, quote, rhetorical devices or hyperbolic rhetoric, unquote, all evidence of this wholesale endorsement of theocratic violence. To the contrary, there were many examples of religiously motivated assaults and murders until the first presidency, in December 1889, publicly abandoned previous Mormon teachings about blood atonement for apostates and about the temporal church's theocratic prerogatives. Moreover, Utah pioneer diaries, correspondence, and church minutes indicate that ordinary Mormons believed that they had the religious obligation to blood atone apostates and to avenge the blood of the prophets on anti-Mormon Gentiles. The fact that many Utah Mormon men did not act upon the norms for violence that Brigham Young and other general authorities promoted is beside the point that those were the officially proved norms of the LDS Church in Pioneer, Utah. Likewise, most Mormon men did not marry polygamously, even though this was an unrelenting norm of the LDS Church until 1890. Nevertheless, Brigham Young did not originate Mormonism's culture of violence. It had been nurtured by Joseph Smith's revelation, theocracy, and personal behavior. Like all prophets before or since, Smith was also influenced by his environment, which included a national culture of violence and its code of male honor. Thank you. Now, we have exactly 10 minutes before this session ends, and we cannot go beyond that because of the meeting which will be held in this room, which will raise your spirits. It will be the comic relief to the dour subject of this session. Yes? Omar, yes?
I'm curious if any comparative information, statistic, qualitative or quantitative, if these Mormon males are any different than their
Well, it wasn't just the Wild Wild West. As I pointed out, it extended from the East Coast to South. It was a national phenomenon of violence. The difference is that Mormonism was the only religious organization in America that that gave sanction to violence in daily life, that sanctioned assault and battery. And because Utah, when it was eventually established in the West, was a theocratic community functioning within the laws of the United States, the dynamic of violence there is completely different than it is. The violence we connect with the Wild Wild West typically occurred where there was no civil authority or it was a very weak civil authority. But in Utah, civil authority was in place from the very beginning. So there was no absence of civil authority that created the vacuum that often resulted in the really violent West that we have images of as well as we can read of. So the dynamics of violence were very different in Utah. The statistics are hard to verify because what ended up in the newspapers isn't necessarily what happened, whether we're talking about Dodge City or Salt Lake or Sacramento or San Francisco. It may not define the full range of violent activity that occurred within the society, but the dynamics unquestionably were completely different in Utah, if we're just looking at Utah. But I was focusing on violence that occurred within the United States before the move to the far west. Yes. Yes.
Do you think it's just a symptom of generally at the time jumping the gun on a lot of events in the latter days, maybe the physical battles of Armageddon being one?
Well, the question is, was this violent culture in America, or pardon me, in Mormonism, a part of its perception? The end of the world is coming, that the violence is going to be involved with the separating of the sheep and the goats. Certainly that's a part of it, too. That's the part of the theocratic side of it, that like I said, that theocracy is not some distant event for Mormons. The revelation in 1833 indicated that theocracy is here and now. And, of course, Latter-day Saints are Latter-day Saints. They perceive themselves in a way far more intense than you may have perceptions of the nearness of the Lord's coming. They had a far more intense and short-term perception of that occurring. And so that millennial context, that this great day of division and death and destruction is going to happen, is certainly a part of it. But Mormons were militarily organized as a society in the sense that there was this regard for the prophet as the spokesman of God on earth. And like I pointed out, when the mobs initially attacked the settlements in Jackson County in 1833, Mormons reacted as pacifists because that was the example that their prophet had given them. And it wasn't until the August 1833 revelation that provided this three-stage pacifist response, followed by an allowance to take revenge at will whenever attacked or threatened. Then Mormons responded as within the confines of that revelation. And so Mormons were not... They did not have the sense of running willy-nilly into violent acts. They did so as they felt they were justified. And so there was what the prophet said and what was published, and in Utah, which I only referred to in passing, what ended up in the Deseret News and the Journal of Discourses for British Saints, published over and over again, became the norms of that society. And so the violence that occurred within a context in which it was approved. That's why I say that it's the society that are crucial, not the existence or non-existence of violence. Did that violence occur within norms? And the millennial context is very important for that within a theocracy. Yes?
How many documented occurrences of blood atonement are there? Is there more than one?
Oh, there are quite a few. Some of them are very well known, some are less well known. There were a series of murders. You can call them murders. Again, it depends on your point of view, whether this was murder or blood atonement authorized by God, in Springville in Utah County, where a family and in-laws and friends were going to leave Utah and because they'd lost faith in Mormonism, and the bishop said that they had back tithing, they hadn't paid. So they were all killed. And the men were blood atoned. Their throats, when they were found, their throats were slit. During the Utah War, there were two cases of women's heads, decapitated heads, being found. One of these is recorded even in the church historian's office journal of this occurring. So there were many incidents that occurred. Now, many, of course, is a qualitative word. Is many a thousand? No, there were not that many that have been verified. But there were allegations of dozens by those who were... particularly in southern Utah. The incidents seem to occur more often in southern Utah. But again, I'm focusing on this earlier period, but certainly more than one. Yes?
Do
No. No, because that would be contrary to Joseph Smith's code of male honor, to be violent with a woman. Although there's an entry in William Clayton's diary about a conflict between Emma and Joseph in the summer of 1843 that seems that there was domestic violence involved. And I think what is more likely that happened is that Emma slapped or scratched Joseph Smith. And it would be inconceivable to me that Joseph, because of his sense of male honor and code of honor, would ever have pushed her or shaken her or certainly not slapped her, used a hand on her. But I think that is what is referred to, but it's only an allusion. It's not specific, but it seems to indicate domestic violence, and I think it was Emma who just beside herself with the situation of this hidden polygamy, keeping being discovered under her own nose, literally, just went into a fury and slapped him. But they divorced, essentially. They separated during that period, but it lasted only a few weeks. They even were dividing their monetary assets, but they reconciled. But it was a tense situation. That's the only incident I know of, and according to your specific question, there is no evidence that I know of a woman, whether she was a house girl or a acquaintance or a wife, ever referring to polygamy, ever referring to violence, observing violence, even in her own defense. I haven't seen anything of that type. Yes?
Do you think that the Mountain Meadows Massacre was an incident of
blood atonement? The Mountain Meadows Massacre occurs within this context of the culture of violence, and in one sense it's the most horrifying example. It is the single largest massacre of a wagon train in U.S. history. You see these old-time westerns of Indians circling wagon trains and massacring them. Well, there were wagon trains that were attacked by various groups, bands, and tribes, but there was no massacre that exceeded the Mountain Meadows Massacre. However, the Mountain Meadows Massacre occurred within a context of sanctioned violence, that the people in southern Utah felt they were doing work in that, and they were also felt that they were in a self-defense. So part of it can be explained by the war hysteria, but there were patterns of violence that were occurring long before and long after the Mountain Meadows Massacre that reflected this violent culture, in the sense that they had the right to blood atone apostates and to take vengeance on those they perceived as enemies, to avenge the blood.
A week before and a week after were unaffected. It was only this one particular.
This one. That's right.
Why was
that? Well, it's complex, but the composition of the wagon train was one of the fatal elements in its being destroyed. It was primarily from Arkansas, and just before the wagon train arrived, the news from Salt Lake arrived in Cedar City that Mormon Apostle Parley P. Pratt had been murdered in Arkansas by an Arkansas man. The mule skinners, the people in the wagon train, were Arkansas. Two different groups had come together. But the mule skinners apparently were from, at least some of them, were from Missouri. At least this is the allegation. And that the mule skinners, teenage boys, young men in their 20s, as they came and talked, apparently, according to the allegations of the settlers in southern Utah, had boasted that they had been a part of the mob and had been involved in driving the Mormons out of Missouri in 1838, or that their parents had, and that they celebrated it. And so that this wagon train, prior to arriving at Mountain Meadows, had, according to stories that came out after the fact, again, were these excuses, I don't know, but according to stories that came out after the fact, they had trouble all the way down as they continued their movement down southern, down the trail into southern Utah with local Mormons. So this wagon train was perceived differently. Whether it was the actions and words of the mule skinners, whether it was the Arkansas background of the families involved, or some combination of all of the above, I think is more likely, but they were perceived differently and disastrously. We're out of time. Thank you very much.